Committee of State on State Government Innovation and Veterans will come to order. Today is Wednesday, February 16th. The first item on the agenda is an overview of the Office of Secretary of State. We have the Secretary of State, Mark Ritchie, not the governor, but the Secretary of State, here to give an overview.
It'll go on for a while.
Mr. Secretary, I just had to do it. I'm trying to take the pressure off that young lad.
Imagine
from the other
his
day.
His mother. Come on.
Thanks for taking time. I know you're busy, and we really appreciate it when the top dogs show up to our committee to give us an insight on exactly what it is your office does. So with that, I'll let you proceed, sir.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and members, and thank you so much for this opportunity. Especially appreciate so many of you have given me time individually in meetings. But I was really grateful to get your letter with a request that we focus a lot on the future and on innovation, which is really, in my mind, the most important thing. So the opening will do kind of overview, and then I want to tackle your specific questions very directly as well, and look forward to questions today and as we go forward. Our mission is to serve the people of Minnesota, and so in that mission, we administer fair and honest elections, promote citizen participation in government, facilitate commerce, and preserve for history the records entrusted to our office. And we do this in some major areas of work. Business services, by far our largest. I'll talk a little bit more about that. Elections, civic education and engagement, official documents and records, and our address confidentiality program, which is called Safe at Home.
Mr. Secretary, and just for the committee, we will have this presentation distributed here shortly, so so you know.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chairman. This slide gives you a general sense of how we break out our work in terms of our staff. You can see about 60% of our staff are in business services. Elections are our second largest, elections and civic engagement. We do a lot of official record keeping and documents. We have a computer division, administration, and then our Safe at Home program is the smallest. So that's just a kind of a general outline as well. In this work, business services is not only our largest single activity. It dominates most of our thinking about how we plan, whether it's our computer planning or our planning around our budget. These major services, and these are our three most important ones, the business formations and filings, the Uniform Commercial Code, which is a system for registering liens and other loans taken on property that is transportable, crops, livestock, semi-trailer trucks, that sort of thing. And notary and apostilles. Apostilles are a kind of super notary used in international trade and international adoptions. These three make up the bulk of our business services. This next slide kind of shows you where that's at. We generate about $28 million each biennium in fees. You give us back around $6 million a year, so there's about a $14 million surplus that is going into the general fund. It's not $6 billion, but it's something. And we consider this a pretty important part of our work because we know that every person filing has a choice. With the online services now and aggressive states like Delaware out there really trying to pull all the filing business to their state, we have to stay on the cutting edge, and we have to make sure our customers feeling very safe with our filings and very secure that they're going to get the service that they need. So this is more or less how we do it, about 2.3 million filings that we track, half a million companies a year use our services. Been a big jump recently because of the economic crisis. We have a lot of citizens who use our services to double check on a company. Maybe somebody came by their house, offered to fix a roof. Maybe someone is imagining partnering or investing in a company. They'll do some due diligence check through our office on things like good standing. A big jump in the business filings. We have steady growth. Minnesota has an incredibly robust new business climate. But in particular, in the last 4 years, you can see we were In the sort of 47,000-48,000 per year range in the last, in the 8 years ago, back to 4 years ago, we've now moved up into the 57,000-58,000 range. 2009, which was, of course, the height or depth of the economic crisis, depending on your view, we had 64,000 new business creations in that year. And we tackled that increase in our work with fewer staff because of the, of course, you know, budget cuts that have come down over the past 4 years. And we've done that primarily through innovation, through technology, through automation. And I'll talk a little bit about some of those specifics. But as I mentioned earlier, because companies have a choice, they don't have to file with us. For us to maintain our attractive position to those companies, to maintain that 60,000 or more new registrations, the UCC filings, all of that, they have to really believe we are the place to come to, and we have done that.
Mr. Chair?
Yes.
Senator Wigert.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Secretary Ritchie, does the Department of Revenue also track this information once it's filed with you?
Mr. Ritchie?
For business?
Mr. Chair, Senator Wigert. Different agencies contact us on occasion to get different pieces of the data. And, for example, we just got a call from Deed, who wanted our most recent new business filings. Some of you know new Representative King Banyan, who's a professor at St. Cloud State. He gets our data quarterly and uses it in his leading economic indicators projections he does for the business community in the St. Cloud area. Revenue and finance, different people take our data for different purposes, and we don't typically ask too many questions. You know, what will you use this for? But we're trying to be more specific about that to see if there are other places where this data can be used. And actually, I will talk just a little bit about that as well.
And Mr. Chair, Secretary Ritchie, maybe it'll be in comments, and we did have a chance earlier to visit on the topic. Do you track once a business has left or going out of business, whatever reason, why they may have left?
Secretary
Mr.
Richard.
Chairman, Secretary Wigert, no, and I wish that we did. I wish that we were developing and compiling additional data that would give us more understanding about our business community, and I'll talk a little bit about that, but that specific thing, no, we do not do that. In fact, this has been a key element of our innovations within that division. The first one has been that as we've digitized for the purposes of automated filings, we have now made it much easier to access data. So a number of the chambers of commerces and business services now have a small arrangement with our office to get the new business creations within their zip code areas. And then they go knock on the door, and that way of in welcoming and encouraging folks. So by digitizing the data, we provide that now very inexpensively, and it's quite easy to get that data. That also allows us to link to additional services. We have both trained our staff. We have folks in from Small Business Administration, Veteran Services, so that our frontline staff are able to provide that information. But we also partner with everyone from the J.J. Hill Library, who provides business services. We know that if any of our new businesses receive assistance training of any kind, it will double their profitability and their likelihood of success. So we focused a lot on that. But the main thing we've done in terms of really saving money and adjusting to the budget cuts that have come down has definitely been the automation of filings. I've spoken to some of you about one particular example, but this has been the case with many. John Deere happens to be our single biggest customer. They file UCC, which is a kind of a lien on their equipment sales and others. Typically, they've been filing about 1,000 a month. And this chart here starts back in 2008. We began partnering with John Deere's technical staff and our technical staff to develop a way for the computers to talk to each other. Essentially, they were an all paper filing back in 2008 and essentially zero electronic filings. And over the past 2 years, we've now crossed our computers talk to each other and about 1,000 filings a month are now being done computer to computer. And to my knowledge, in this year, there have been zero paper filings. Now, this has saved John Deere a tremendous amount of money, staff time. It's cut a couple days off the filing process. But for us, inside of our office, it has allowed us to take one person and be able to redeploy that person to handle phones and in person. Our goal, essentially, is to take everything that can be computer-to-computer filing and to apply that principle and then to redeploy people to make sure we have human beings there when somebody needs that kind of assistance. John Deere is just one of them, you know, just one of the, you know, examples of that, you know, that kind of work, of that kind of opportunity. They happen to be our biggest customer, but that's a good example. Now, when we think about moving forward, I'll come back later to our business services. We try to take some of the same principles in our second largest division, which is elections. Elections are a little bit different than business services in that they are largely a partnership. Elections are mostly run at the local level.
Mr. Ritchie,
Yes, Mr. Chairman.
I just popped in my mind a question that I've been asked before. If we went back to that other slide, a question that has popped up is why wouldn't something like commerce be handling this? I mean, it was just a question,
yes.
and I thought maybe you could explain your yep. thoughts.
Mr. Chairman, Uniform Commercial Code, which is a federal law, created a system. I often compare it to the system we have for mortgages. If you have a home or an office building that's sitting in a county, you'll register the fact that you've borrowed money against it with the county recorder's office. It's not going anyplace. You're not going anyplace. But if you're borrowing money against soybeans or livestock or a semi-trailer that moves around, the Uniform Commercial Code system developed a kind of national registry and a state-based system for registering those liens. We partner actually with county recorders, but we are the system where the fact that that money has been borrowed against that crop is noted. So when a farmer comes in with a soybean crop to an elevator, the elevator checks with our office to make sure there isn't now a lien or some other mortgage type encumbrance on that crop. If it's clear, then they go. And so John Deere, which is selling machinery and selling a lot of machinery, our office becomes the place, and has been for a really long time, for those UCC filings. I don't know Department of Commerce's mission. I don't know their, you know, all of the different things that they do. But this has been historically part of business services of the state and has resided. And to my knowledge, the other 50 offices of Secretary of State in other parts of the United States all also do the UCC filings as well. So there must be some history about how it first ended up in the Office of Secretary of State.
Thank you.
In the elections section, we partner with the county attorneys. They do everything related to investigations, prosecutions. Township and city clerks, they are finding the polling locations. They're hiring, training the election judges, paying election judges. They handle some of the absentee voting. The county auditors are our chief election officials in each county. They are kind of the backbone of our system. They handle the voter registration and all aspects of that. They are the sort of owners of the list of voters. They handle candidate filings at the local level, and now we partner with them. They produce the ballots. They forward election night results. They're responsible largely for the election equipment. These are our partners, and we keep their interests in mind as we innovate from our side. Our office is responsible for training and providing a certification to the county election staff. Typically, the county auditor is the name that often goes with that job. We accept candidate filings as do the counties, and so we share that responsibility in some respects. I convene the state canvassing board. We provide the backbone computer services. The county auditors own their list of voters, but we provide the computer system by which they can maintain and function as a statewide system within a county kind of a responsibility. The election night reporting, that's the system that reports the election results on the evening. And then many of you have perhaps purchased or rented one of our list of voters, which are available to candidates and elected officials. So within that framework of our work, we've had a lot of opportunities for innovation because the technology has continued to evolve dramatically. And I just want to highlight a couple of them that have helped us not just save money, but I think provide much better service. One of them is electronic transmission of ballots. Many of you know the difficulty often of our soldiers and others serving in the military in terms of getting ballots in a timely way overseas. Also, anyone on business or a student overseas. We got authority from the legislature a few years ago to be able to transmit ballots electronically. They're printed and mailed back. It's been incredible savings in time, in money, and hassle, and also has dramatically increased the successful voting by our military personnel. We also were able to build a special website for our military and overseas voters with a simple 1, 2, 3 that made it extremely easy and answered almost all of the questions, and that sharply reduced phone calls, emails, and faxes into our county election officials who were handling a much greater load of phone and other kind of inquiries than they needed to. That has helped evolve a broader range of online voter information tools. Perhaps you've used these yourself. Online lookup. It used to be that on election day, some publications would publish some of the polling places, but there were just literally thousands of phone calls to our office, to county offices, and to politicians. Where do I vote? And so the online lookup tool has been an incredible innovation. And in the last couple years, we've gone a little further. We now have online lookup for, what's your status in terms of being a registered voter. We also have a new system for an online lookup to track the progress of an absentee ballot. Each of these, although it took a financial investment to make them, has tremendously reduced the amount of work in our office to a certain extent, but especially in local offices as well. Another innovation that's really been important for us has been electronic list matching. The quality of electronic list has improved, but also the procedures for matching has improved. We now use the National Change of Address from the U.S. Postal Service to sharply reduce our same-day registrations. I think 3/4 of the people using the same-day registration are simply changing their address. We now have permission from the legislature, and we have implemented a procedure of running our voter list against federal change of address forms. If somebody has changed, there's a system for automatically updating their address and as a service to the voter, making sure that they know that and that all of that is in proper order. But it's a tremendous time saver for the local election officials because they don't have to type it in again, make a mistake in typing, and all those things.
Senator Olson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Mr. Ritchie. On that topic, on the same-day registration, it's interesting that you can update addresses even before they may have appeared at the polls for attempting to do a same-day registration. I understand that the Secretary of State's office does a follow-up mailing of same-day registration, and when is that done, and what kind of a return do you get, or do you get rejected, undeliverables or what? And then how does that affect, if it's undeliverable, do you take them out of the, or do they continue as registered at the address to which you mailed that card?
Secretary Ritchie.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Olson. So it'd be two completely different operations. One is when somebody is has completed their process of changing their address, they get a card that says, as a service to you, we've updated your address, that this is not your address. Please let us know. It's non-forwardable if it comes back. And keep in mind, all of these are controlled by the county. So the county would then, either make the adjustment or they would say this, this was a typo, somebody mistyped the address. And if somebody says, no, I don't want to any longer be on the voter list or anything like that. That's up to the county to remove them. But on same-day registration, which is a separate time, you know, on Election Day, the counties then mail a postal verification card. Any postal verification cards that come back are reviewed by the county auditor to determine if there was a typo or to see if there was some mistake that was made to that. If they cannot determine, you know, the exact circumstance or why it came back, or if there's something that seems funny to them, those are typically turned over to the county attorney. this is something that the counties handle, the county auditor, typically the county election official, and the county attorney, so it's not something that we handle. But it's a system that has, you know, been basically the same one in place for a very long period of time. And adding the capacity to update people's addresses has mostly had the impact of reducing the number of same-day registrations, and it could reduce them dramatically. It could reduce them up to 75% if the whole system was working properly.
So, Mr. Chairman, Mr. Ritchie, does you've said the procedure at the county, but is the process, if it's determined that it was truly not deliverable, are they removed? Or do they stay because they registered? Are they registered even if you couldn't account for them living at the address that they said they were at?
Secretary Richard.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Olson, if there's some problem, they're turned over to the county attorney for investigation. So at that point, they're not, you know, they're not on the rolls at that point.
Okay. Thank you.
Mr. Chair.
Please state your name.
Beth Fraser with the Office of the Secretary of State. If somebody's postcard is returned and we can't, if the county can't determine that they're eligible, then in addition to being turned over to the county attorney at that point, if they're a same-day registrant, their record is also flagged as challenged, so that at the next election there is a notation for the election judges to ask some questions about, you know, do you really live here? So there is a flag put on their record.
Thank you.
Go ahead.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. For a long time, the courts provided information about people who had been convicted of felonies and incarcerated on paper files, which were not very convenient for working with by the counties. Again, those have to go to the counties. We've recently been able to get those on electronic databases. Also, the legislature last session authorized us to use the corrections electronic database. For a long time, we only had access to the State Department of Health death records. Of course, a number of Minnesotans are in Florida or Texas or some other place when they die. It was very difficult, and I don't know about you, but I've certainly had the experience of calling up a household and asking for someone and realizing with the pause at the other end of the phone that that person had died and that was not indicated in any way in terms of an update in the database. So we got your authority to use the National Social Security Death Registry, and this has been a really big help, changed in that way. Department of Public Safety provides us data based on their driver's license indication for non-citizen data. So the innovation is the availability of electronic list and the authorization from the legislature to use those lists to help update and clean up the databases. And there's a lot of reasons for that, and one of them is just, you know, saving money for everybody who's involved in the process. Being able to make these innovations has sometimes cost quite a bit of money on the front end, but that investment for our purposes has been a cost savings over time, but it's also been an important cost savings to our partners. Some innovations that have been suggested more are cost shifting to our local partners, and so we're quite sensitive to make sure that we're not doing that. The Minnesota Constitution and the legislature has mandated several other responsibilities that are smaller in a way from a staffing point of view, but they're no less important, and we put a lot of emphasis on them. We're the state's official record keeper, and some of you know we have the whole record file of all the signed legislation that you and your predecessors, starting in the Territorial Congress, have signed. But any kind of emergency decrees, appointments, authorizations, assignments, you know, we have those documents. We operate the state's open appointment process. It's one of the things tasked to us. We have some ideas about how that could be more modern and online, but for the moment, there's a process of the open appointments. We're the paper shufflers in that. We produce the legislative manual, the blue book. I hope you have one, and if you don't, we have a few extras, but for some reason, this is not only an important kind of snapshot, but we also produce a student version that's highly praised and highly appreciated throughout the state, used by a lot of teachers. The Minnesota Public Land Survey, some of you know that we for a very long time were the keepers of that. We've been able to partner with a lot of organizations to digitize it, so it's kind of an incredible resource now, and we have officially transferred it to the Minnesota Historical Society, so it sits inside of a much larger electronic database. So we're the state record keeper, and as a result, I sit on the Minnesota Historical Society board as part of my job. We have a public safety responsibility. It's primarily located in our Safe at Home Address Confidentiality Program. The legislature created this program before I was elected, but I was in office when the funding was first provided. The implementation has been fairly rapid, and it's kind of a simple program. It's actually modeled on one that's in about half the other states. A person who feels at risk, somebody in law enforcement, somebody in the judiciary, somebody who's been the victim of domestic violence or threatened by a stalker, has the right under Minnesota law to have an confidential address. They have a P.O. box that is their official address. Their driver's license has that. Their other documents. We have staff who go to that post office box and then forward on a confidential basis first-class mail, and this is a way that someone can live safely and live securely. About 1,000 people. In fact, now it's a little over 1,000 people have been served already. And in talking to law enforcement and others, they say to me flat out, this program has saved lives. So we know that there's a lot of appreciation in the law enforcement community for this. We engage in civic education and engagement. We want to make sure we stay number one in voter turnout, but we also want to make sure people are very well informed about our nation's history and culture and heritage and the underlying principles of our democracy. We use primarily when there's a significant historical hook. We don't have much money for this, so we look for opportunities. Minnesota had a sesquicentennial. We brought in the Declaration of Independence in a partnership with Hubbard Broadcast and Dolan Media. Had the largest crowd that the Declaration of Independence showing had ever had in the country. Was an incredible opportunity, and there's still resonance of that still today. This year is the Civil War sesquicentennial, and we're making arrangements to bring the U.S. Constitution here in the fall. And again, we'll be trying to partner with local companies, media organizations, foundations, and others to provide the funds to do that, because it's not something we can do within our budget. Vote in Honor of Vet has been one of our most important and successful program, helping people to think about public service and those who sacrifice for our democracy. We partner with the Minnesota Department of Veteran Affairs, the Association for the U.S. Army, Minnesota Assistance Council for Veterans, and kids voting to last year, I think about 80,000 people wore one of these buttons. They wrote in the name of a veteran. I always do my dad, who was a Marine in the Second World War. And they wrote their tributes and remembrances of those veterans, and we put them into the blue book, which you have. If you look through there, there'll be veterans and remembrances of those from your own districts. And then we had those authors come to the state capitol and to read them out loud. And it was a very powerful reminder of what public service really is about. And we pay a lot of attention to symbols of democracy as a way to help educate and inform, especially our young people, but not just young people, about what underlies our culture, our society. The flag etiquette brochure I handed around is by far the most requested material that we produce. It's probably about 10 times more than any other that we have. We are especially interested this year with the Civil War sesquicentennial that the state capitol is such a symbol of that. So, you know, we are engaged in those activities, but we don't have a lot of funding, so we always do those in partnerships. You asked the question straight up, how does the Office of Secretary of State contribute to the improvement of Minnesota? One of your key questions. We think of it in business, in society, and democracy. In business, we help 60,000 people turn their dream of a business into a reality each year, and we help a half a million other businesses to grow stronger, and we network them together because we know that will make our economy even better. And we spend a lot of time trying to educate some of our neighbors and friends about the importance of self-employment, creating your own business in addition to jobs and some of the other conversations. In society, we are there to help people when they need some assistance to be safe. We are a key component when people are doing overseas adoption. We're a strong promoter of service, public service, reminding people of military service and service to the nation and service in the community, that as a society, as a democracy, we don't function unless there is an appreciation and participation, respect for public service. And the democracy, we are engaged in activities to make sure we stay number one in voter turnout, but we balance those activities to make sure that our voters are well informed about current events, our history, our culture, our heritage underneath that. We want a lot of voters, and we want them to be well-informed. Your next question was, what do you think can be changed about our office to make it operate more efficiently? Here are a few things that we think of as we look forward. Online filings. I mentioned what we had done for John Deere. We are working hard to expand all of our services so all businesses can appreciate and enjoy those savings and time and money. But also, we're going to have less staff. So we're going to have to find ways to have computers talking to each other so that our staff can be there when somebody needs them to answer a very specific question. We've started to work in cloud computing, and this has been a very exciting and a very cost-saving opportunity for us. We partner with OET. We've thought, well, look, we have a big database. Department of Public Safety has a big database. Maybe there's some cloud computing solution that's out there that could really help us all. Digital imagery. We've digitized a lot of our files. We sometimes have businesses who want us to go back further. Digitizing a lot of the imagery is going to be important. We just don't know how.
Senator Wager, excuse me.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Perhaps everyone knows, but what's cloud computing?
Secretary Ritchie.
Mr. Chairman, Secretary Wager, right now the Office of Secretary of State maintains between 100 and 150 individual computer servers, and all of our stuff is done on that. We maintain those. We buy those. We partner with Office of Enterprise Technology. We are responsible for that. If a hacker from China attacks that series of computers, they take us down. You know, that's our worry. Cloud computing is the idea that some companies provide a very, very large-scale, more or less internet-based service that becomes the place where your data resides and you operate back and forth within that cloud computing. And we are experimenting with it in our business services on some things that come very naturally in that way. And we have questions because on Election Day we must be number one. And so we're cautious in that way. But cloud computing, and I'm no expert, but it seems to be where the efficiencies for large-scale databases will come. We maintain perhaps the largest of the state's databases, the voter file, because it's cumulative, but certainly Department of Public Safety maintains an equally complex data. There's others, so when you start getting into large-scale databases, cloud computing appears to be one of the potential efficiencies, and we're experimenting with it in some place we feel safe and secure to see how it goes. OET, I think, has a whole separate division now and maybe a new contract on this, so I'm wanting to learn more. Applications for handheld devices. Everybody says we're going to handheld.
Senator Dibble.
Oh, thanks. I was just going to provide further clarification or explanation as a kind of metaphor. Some individuals, for example, Senator Wager, are treating their laptops or their desktops as more of a portal. Kind of going back to the old way we used to have these desktops that kind of plugged into a mainframe. A lot of folks now are moving to having their software, like Microsoft Word, for example, not resident on your own computer, but out in the internet, and your files you don't save to your C drive, you save out in the internet somewhere. That's cloud computing. Yeah, the internet is the cloud.
Thank you very much. Mr. Chairman, the last one, e-notary and e-apostilles. I just returned from our conference of Secretary of State. There's a new Hague Convention on e-apostilles, and some countries want them, prefer them with their adoptions and with their trade. So sort of the electronic version of what we do now as notary, what we do now as apostilles, is certainly something that could gain us efficiency, but also it's probably important for keeping some customers, especially in the real estate in the mortgage industry. Innovations, from our point of view, are both to help our office be more efficient, but also to help our partners, our companies, our local officials. Voter registration, we now have a tool so citizens can look up their voter registration, but they still have to do registrations by hand. A whole lot of states have gone to online registration and saved a ton of money. That's something we could consider. We now track absentee ballots online. We could go further and track our mail ballots online, saving the counties and the local officials quite a bit of money in that way. Company identity theft has been growing from something that was in a couple states to maybe 22 or 23 now. It's getting to be a national problem. It's like a company's identity is stolen and used to do fraudulent purchasing, that kind of thing. There's ways that we can install additional password protection to help law enforcement in particular, but just to help companies who are our partners. Information gathering for business, just gathering more information can help businesses go stronger and see new markets, kind of like the Chamber of Commerce is, who are using our new business filings. Online open appointments. The open appointment process, it appears to me, has been more or less the same for years and years and years. There are lots of ways that it could be set up so there's just a better information flow more online. One stop for business registration. It's been talked about for 25 years, I think, but the notion that businesses can come to one place, register once, and all of their different filings, whether it's commerce or whatever, could be done in a single place. This is a very important idea, and the cloud computing might help us with that. So are there efficiencies in our office that could be applied to other agency? Was your third and final question? Yes. Online filings, electronic databases, all of that has been really important to us. And yes, there's different protocols of how middle names are handled and all of that stuff, but this is a huge factor for us, and we believe it could be useful to others. We work a lot with the Office of Enterprise Technology. They supply our phones. We do a lot of things with them. They help us with our database security and our internet penetration protection. That's been a very important partnership for us. We are a little tiny agency, and the hackers are much stronger and smarter than us, so OET is our backbone in that. I mentioned electronic database matching, public-private partnerships. When John Deere and our office started talking, we knew it would take the best technical minds on both, and it took both to make that happen. When we wanted to bring the Declaration of Independence in, we had to sit down with companies and media partners. When we want to make a change in our election law and how we handle it, we have to work with the townships, the cities. The partnerships for us has been really important. And then don't close the counter. That's a few years ago, there was a big budget crunch, and the Office of Secretary of State's business counter was closed part-time to save money, and it created business havoc across the country. It disrupted our process of filings and everything else, and companies in other parts of the country came to view Minnesota very negatively as a place that wasn't open for business, that wasn't very, was kind of a backwater. And that had a real dramatic effect on our law firms and others who service businesses, because businesses began to say, no, we're not going to file in Minnesota. We're going to file in Delaware or some other place because Minnesota just doesn't have it together. And so when we think about efficiencies and we think about what we need to do, we're always in our minds trying to say we need to make sure that whatever's happening, we make sure that not just that the counter is open, but that people feel like they get the very best service. And in fact, for us, the bottom line question is customer satisfaction. Are the prices for the things that people get from us in line, are they fair? Are the filing fees fair? Is the technology there so that they can work with us so their staff is very efficient, like John Deere? They cut 2.5 days off of filings. And third, are the people that they're dealing with, when they need to talk to people, courteous, thoughtful, knowledgeable, experienced, and there to help make sure things are right. We pride ourselves in this. We are often getting emails and notes from people who express their appreciation for our devotion to that kind of view. And this was an email that came just a little bit ago. He says, as a representative of the single largest filers of UCCs, and I think he said in the known universe or something, I speak to a lot of jurisdictions on a regular basis. I often get quick service, and I often get treated professionally and courteously. However, today, when calling your office and speaking to Teresa, I was honored with the best that anyone could expect. The phone rang once. I was greeted graciously. I then got all the information that I needed so quickly I could hardly believe the call was complete. Teresa's use of your system was not only impressive, but her manner was delightful. I want to be sure that you know that we, the public, appreciate that kind of top-notch service. For us, this is the ultimate for what we look for to see if we are meeting our mission. Are we making sure that people are served in a way that they appreciate, that they feel respected, and do they get done the business they need to get done so that we can be of service to them, either as a business community or as a voter or someone else? So, Mr. Chairman, thank you again for your questions, for helping us think into the future, and I'd like to take any questions that you or anyone else might have in to complete this overview.
All right. Thank you very much, Mr. Secretary. Any questions for Secretary Ritchie? All right. Thank you. Thank you very much.
Sir. Thank you very much.
Second item on the agenda is an overview from the Revenue Department.
Really wish the governor hadn't
been. And we'll have Mr. Solomon, Commissioner.
Is there at all?
Come forth.
Who's just complimenting on the
Salamone. Salamone, excuse me. And I know Secretary Ritchie really put on a show here today and took a few minutes of your time, Commissioner, but you'll have to work it out with him down the road, okay?
Mr. Chair,
all right.
Revenuers are not as
as exciting.
Sort of sedate.
All right, sir, thank you. You may proceed when ready.
Thank you.
Couldn't read what he was going to do.
Mr. Chair and members, it's my privilege to be here to share with you some information about the Department of Revenue and answer any questions you may have about us. I'm honored to be here in the presence of my own senator, Senator Wieger. So I'm sure he'll protect me here in committee. I want to basically give you a high-level review of the Department of Revenue, our mission, our vision, and what we do on a day-to-day basis. And there are many things that we're doing that answer the questions, Mr. Chair, that you raised about efficiency. I think that's really the frontier of government service is to find ways to be more efficient. The mission of the Department of Revenue is to make the revenue system work well for the state of Minnesota. The revenue system encompasses all of the processes and things that we do to serve as taxpayers. Our vision, and this comes from our strategic plan, which I hope by the end of this meeting we'll be able to have you a copy of our strategic plan. Our vision is that everyone pays the right amount of tax, no more or no less. So if, in fact, the taxpayer has overpaid, we certainly deal with that in the same way that we would pursue a taxpayer who is underpaid taxes. So it's a very neutral sort of approach to tax administration.
Mr. Commissioner. Just a minute. I want to remind members, if you're talking, they're telling me it's being picked up. So if you just swing your mic to the side, please. Thank
Senator
you.
Orban's
Go ahead, Commissioner.
The next slide shows what we call our compliance cycle. The Revenue Department has a number of things that we have to do every day, continuously throughout the year, in order to serve taxpayers. And we view this compliance cycle as kind of our life cycle, if you will. It encompasses all of the most important processes that we do. The first one on the chart is to inform taxpayers. That is to interpret the law and to inform taxpayers of their obligations and rights. Taxpayers deserve that, and they deserve clarity. And anything that can be done to make tax laws more simple and straightforward and understandable would be a wonderful thing in terms of tax compliance. We also provide taxpayers with a service and the information they need to meet their obligations, and that involves giving them forms that are clear and understandable, interpretations of law, and any other tools that we think they need to fulfill their tax obligations, which is to file in a timely and accurate way. We process returns and payments. We issue refunds, and we manage taxpayer accounts. It's just an awful lot of paper that comes through the Department of Revenue, although I should say that paper seems to be becoming less and less an issue as we are moving into the electronic age. So I'll have some information for that soon here. So we process a lot of returns. We audit to resolve discrepancies and to discourage tax evasion and to identify levels and patterns of noncompliance. So we have done studies to try to understand the patterns of noncompliance. We enforce the tax laws for those who do not comply voluntarily. And we identify and recommend improvements to the revenue system. So if you look at the cycle, we start by informing taxpayers. We provide service to taxpayers. We process returns as we receive them. We audit returns to make sure taxpayers are fulfilling their obligations. We enforce if necessary, if they're not. And most importantly, and as important, I guess, is that we make recommendations to the governor, to the legislature, about areas where tax policy can be improved for the sake of better tax administration. Annually, we serve $3.7 million individual income taxpayers, 165,000 withholding taxpayers, about 800,000 property tax refund claimants, 284,000 businesses that collect and remit sales tax, 204,000 corporations and S-corporations, partnerships that pay the corporate franchise tax and income taxes, 48,000 fiduciary income taxpayers, and so on. We also serve the 3,300 local units of government in the state of Minnesota. We administer the overhead that relates to the local property tax.
Mr. Chairman?
Which should not be minimized, I should point out.
Senator Olson.
Mr. Chairman, just a point of clarification. What do you mean by withholding taxpayers? I would think there would be a huge number that would have their taxes being withheld from their paychecks. This must mean something less than everybody who has their taxes withheld.
Mr. Chair, Senator Olson, it relates to all that we have to do to make sure that the income taxes has integrity, the income tax form and the withholding that's shown there. And sitting next to me is Assistant Commissioner Terry Steinblock. I'm sorry, I should have introduced her at the beginning. She's our Assistant Commissioner for the Individual Income Tax, and maybe she can give you a better answer.
So Mr. Chair, Ms. Steinblock, or Mr. Salamone, whether that is some people that you have to deal with on an individual basis because of some issue, or is it everybody that's having taxes withheld?
Assistant Commissioner Steinblock.
Mr. Chair, members, it could be a combination of either individual taxpayers or it's businesses who are responsible for handling the withholding for individuals.
Okay. Thank you.
Yes.
Commissioner Salamone, I just want to give you a little heads up. It is my intent that at 2:10 that we will have the Attorney General with us here today if we can make that happen.
Okay, Mr. Chair, I have a number of slides flagged quick with an exclamation mark, so I'll be skipping over those slides.
Again, you'll have to take that up with Secretary of State.
In fact, my very next slide says quick. But we do provide a lot of forms and instructions to over 4 million taxpayers, and I think you're impressed with everything we do in terms of numbers. The next slide shows our base budget before Governor's Rec, so you get a sense of what our budget looks like, at least the base budget that we've been working from. And we can move along. The next slide is titled Direct Compliance versus Compliance Support. Over the years, going back about 11 years or so, the department was very different. We had 52% of our department was support functions, sort of backroom functions like HR and IT and the various things you need to keep the agency running. 52% of that was support, and only 48% of it was direct compliance activity, auditors and collectors in the field collecting taxes. If you look over to 2012 and 2013, the ratios have changed substantially because of continuous compliance initiatives that we have done over the years. We've done about 7 tax compliance initiatives whereby the legislature gives us money to raise more tax revenue as a part of closing what we call the tax gap, the difference between what taxpayers owe and what we actually collect.
Senator Daley.
Mr. Commissioner, I have a fairly easy question, hopefully. I have a chart that shows that your department has approximately $19.7 million in unencumbered funds, $11.3 in tax systems management, and $4.9 in AR management. How much of that has been accumulated due to hiring freezes or delays in hiring?
Mr. Commissioner.
Mr. Chair, Senator, we can get you pretty precise answer. A big chunk of it, I suspect, is due to the recent acquisition of our new tax processing system, which I hope I have some time to tell you about. But we're excited about that, and that would be a piece of it. And Dan Ostick, my financial guy here, if he's still around, might be able to hit a few more of the big pieces of that.
Welcome. Please state your name.
Thank you. For the record, my name is Dan Ostick. I'm the Financial Management Director at the Department of Revenue. Thanks for the question. I appreciate it. And the answer to that is some of the balances are because of a hiring freeze. We estimate that we're going to have roughly $5 million at the end of the biennium to turn back to the general fund. I can give you some examples if you'd like, and I know you're pressed for time, of what is not encumbered. We use a different accounting method than a lot of agencies do within MAPS. We're one of 3 agencies to use the standard projection method. And so it shows big balances for us, but it's not really the case. But there are, you know, such as our seasonal staffing has not been encumbered yet because they're not in yet. Stuff like that. So does that answer your question?
It does. Thank you.
I do have more information if you need it.
Thank you. Thank you very much.
So looking at the two pie charts, you can see over the last 12 years, the shift from 52% of our agency being in a support mode and the 48% in a direct compliance mode. Today, it's about a 1/3, 2/3 relationship. 33% of our agency is in support mode and 67% of it is direct compliance. And so far it's working fine, but the pressures are building on that support side, and we do everything we can to sort of make that work. I think it's an important shift in the agency. On the next chart, it shows our increase in the number of FTE in the agency that are related to compliance initiative funding. So you'll see an increase in numbers of employees, but it's primarily a result of continuous compliance initiatives. If you look at the black bars, it indicates a drop. It shows the trend in reduced support functions in the agency, or that portion of the agency being reduced.
So, Mr. Chairman?
Senator Olson?
Mr. Chairman, Commissioner Salamoy, maybe I'm misreading this too. If you support, I presume also is support to even to taxpayers responding to questions and concerns. It would seem to me that the less support you have, the more problems you have, and so therefore the more compliance you do. Is that a self-fulfilling prophecy that we're creating the problems that require the compliance because of shortchanging the support side?
Mr.
Or how
Commissioner.
Would you
Chair,
correct my logic?
Senator Olson, actually, when I talk in terms of support, the support functions, these are all internal
okay.
to the agency. It's not the external, you know, auditors and collectors going out.
Okay, thank you.
And so it's all the backroom functions. And there's a list on the slide just before the pie charts. You'll see a list of what we consider to be support and what we consider to be more direct compliance. So it's all the backroom things that we need to do in order to make things happen outside the agency. Department obviously, like any agency, has challenges, and we work hard to deal with those. We are in the process of completing our new our tax processing system. The short version of this is it's on time, it's on budget, and we're terribly excited about how much more services we're going to be able to provide the taxpayers as a result of having a system that is integrated and seamless. And so when the taxpayer calls now, we know when we give them data about their account, it's going to be accurate. Under our old system, which was a hodgepodge, you can see the colored matrix there. Every color is a different system and a different process. And you can imagine trying to get a correct answer to a taxpayer with that kind of a homegrown system. And it was homegrown. We didn't have resources to buy a real modern tax processing system.
Mr. Commissioner, is there an acronym to this new program that some might have heard around the Capitol? Or
Mr. Chair, if you're referring to the tax processing system,
right?
Of course, there's no shortage of acronyms around here. But this one, the company is called Fast Enterprises. Okay. And by the way, all the principals of this company are former tax administrators. That helps a lot. The product is called GenTax. And internally, in terms of branding internally, we called it OneSource as a project to get all the employees rallied and keep them pumped up. So it's been a great project. We are in the tail end of it. In fact, we're now beginning discussions of decommissioning these old legacy systems, getting rid of all those colored squares. So there will be great benefit to this when it is completed. It is fully funded, so we're ready to go. It's just a matter of completing the implementation. There's a schedule on the next slide that shows where we're at, and basically we're done. There's some few things that we need to do toward the tail end that would provide some additional functionality with regards to taxpayer relationships. And other than that, I think we're in pretty good shape. We put a blank slide there with no colors, or all one color, just to emphasize the fact that we've gotten rid of all that stuff and we're ready to go rock and roll with the new system. In terms of efficiencies, very quickly, I will flag, first of all, this integrated tax system is going to be incredibly, make us incredibly more efficient. Yes, Mr. Chair.
Senator Gazelka.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I've got about three or four questions, if that's okay. I'll try to make them brief. But it's based off of this expanded tax compliance initiative. And I want to address that because I get that we have an opportunity to raise more revenue, but I'm also concerned about undue pressure and hassles on those that are doing it right. So just some briefly, one of the questions I had was you identified in this report 6,446 non-compliant sales tax and 377 non-compliant corporate tax, but how many were compliant? How many people are getting that extra touch from Minnesota Revenue as far as these audits?
Commissioner Salamone.
Mr. Chair, Representative Gazelka, I'm not sure how to answer that. In terms of, we focus on areas that where there's less than perfect or less than acceptable compliance with the tax laws. And so by definition, if you took the total number of corporations, subtracted off the ones for which we had to take action to bring them into compliance, I think you would get the number that you're looking for. But I sense you may be concerned about taxpayers getting audited maybe more than one time or too frequently. We're starting to track that to make sure that that doesn't happen. And so we've been hearing that feedback as well. And so that's a hot topic in our department right now.
Senator Gazelka.
In fact, that was one of my next questions. Are you getting many complaints from this? And so, if complaints are rising, one of the initiatives I think both we in the Senate and the House and even the governor want to we want to become more business friendly, which deals with permitting issues. But I think this is also another issue. If businesses feel like there's unnecessary pressure on a regular basis, it's right, why do it here when we can do it somewhere else? And so one of the other questions I have is, how do we compare to neighboring states with the employees that we have assigned to this versus like Wisconsin, South Dakota, North Dakota? Because I see the governor's initiative here, it looks like it calls for another 81 additional compliance employees, and I want to make sure that we don't get this out of balance, with our quest to make sure people are compliant. I don't want to get out of balance with becoming more business unfriendly.
Commissioner? Mr. Chair, Senator Gazelka, I certainly understand your concern. And if you looked at a chart of states and their compliance effort, we'd probably rank near the top, or at least near the top half, for sure. And it's because of the emphasis on compliance initiatives. But one of the issues is it's not just the compliance initiative. It's the fact that when we get them, we have to get a lot of people up to, train them very quickly. They're often very young people coming into the agency. They may not have the bedside manner that we would like them to have, so we have to be concerned about not just the hard skills of auditing and collecting, but the skills of interpersonal in terms of how a taxpayer might perceive our auditors. So we have, and we continue to talk about that internally, how we can do that in a way that gives us a better result in terms of our relationship with the taxpayer. That's really important for us.
Senator Kozelka.
One last comment, too. I know you guys work hard and do the best of your ability, but you know that the IRS and Minnesota Revenue probably are about the same in the eyes of the constituents, and I just want to make sure that I just need to say that I'm concerned when we continue to rise that number. If we're in the top or the top compared to neighboring states, it's again another thing that makes us uncompetitive against neighboring states. So I am concerned about that.
Thank you for that feedback.
Senator Ortman.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And Commissioner Salamone, it's always good to see you.
Thank you.
Your folks do great work.
Thank you.
My question follows up on Senator Gazelka's, though. There has been an expectation that every dollar assigned in budget for compliance will end up or result in a certain dollar amount in return. Can you talk about that and about what the trend has been, where we're at now with the expectation of what we expect to accomplish with each dollar spent?
Mr. Chair, Senator Ortman, good question. We track our ROI, if you will, on compliance initiatives very carefully.
Return on investment.
Return on investment, thank you. I mentioned that we had done, we've done seven compliance initiatives. The very first one had a return on investment of 10 to 1. Yep. And as we have done successive compliance initiatives, that rate of return has fallen. And we are now, the one that we're currently working on now, we expect to get about a 4 to 1 rate of return. And I suspect if we continue doing those, the rate of return will drop accordingly. So it's a good question to think about.
Senator Ortman.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And Mr. Salamone, we have talked about this before, and I was wondering if you've ever done anything to study when taxpayers might settle, even though they might feel like they have a legitimate disagreement, because it costs too much to challenge the audit results. And I've talked to taxpayers who have done that same thing, who have said, we've already spent so much with our accountant to try and work through these audits, and then it just doesn't make any sense to try and challenge the result. Have you studied that? Are you working on that? What can you tell us about it?
Commissioner?
Mr. Chair, I think I'll ask Terry, who's a little closer to that, to respond.
Assistant.
Chair, Senator. There's a few things that we're doing in that area. We've met with some public tax professional groups, and they've made some suggestions to us that we think will help in that area. At any time throughout the audit process, the taxpayer does have the right to ask questions or to bring up issues and concerns. Settlement agreements are something that the taxing divisions do look at as a component of resolving that particular debt. We also have the Taxpayer Rights Advocates Office, which plays into that as well, which is an independent body within the agency that provides direction and assistance to the taxpayers there. But we are also adding to a piece of feedback that we received was exactly what you talked about. It gets so far down the process, and maybe there's a disagreement between the taxpayer and the auditor, and they're frustrated or they're not sure what to do, and it's been so time-consuming. And so one of the things that we are doing as part of our audits when we go out is sending out a pre-audit letter, which educates the taxpayer as to what their rights are. It also provides information as to the supervisor's name and phone number, so that if they feel like it's becoming too time-consuming or there's issues that aren't being resolved, they have the opportunity to contact the supervisor and work through some of those issues as well. I think there's some enhancements that the commissioner is going to talk about as well as in the area of the data warehouse and making sure that we're looking to audit those that are out of compliance versus no change audits or audits where there may be a refund. So there's a variety of different things that we're looking at and we're working on, and we'll talk about a few of them as enhancements if that helps.
All right. All good questions. Thank you. But we're going to stay on track, and I'm still planning on having the Attorney General here in about 4 minutes.
Mr. Chair, I can very quickly rattle off for you and the committee those items that we think have brought great efficiency to the Department of Revenue, many of which can be extended to other agencies, and maybe we'll have an offline conversation, or so I'll come back and talk about that. Certainly, number one, the integrated tax system is going to give us a tremendous increase in efficiency. We know that. We see it already, and that's number one. Number two, we are number one in electronic filing. There's no state that has more electronic filed returns than Minnesota. We're proud of that. Our department is almost literally paperless. It was a goal that we set a while back. We are partnering with other state agencies with regard to capturing Minnesota revenues owed through revenue recapture programs. We are engaged in data warehousing where we can use the data that we have to provide better and more targeted audits to use that kind of intelligence. We're doing video conferencing to minimize the travel expenses. We used to have, every employee used to have a laptop and a desktop, and we've literally now have one computer per employee, and it's a laptop on their desk. It's a lot easier for us to manage. That's going to save some time. Terry is now leading a process on dealing with large volumes of return mail. It's a lean project under the banner of lean, and that's going to be very helpful. I mentioned the integrated tax system. At the end of the project, we're adding on something called taxpayer access point, which means a taxpayer can come into our system through the integrated tax system and update their own tax accounts and so on, just like you would if you were working with your bank. That's going to be very important to us. We have installed an extranet, which is a secure internet. We can pass confidential data across a secure network with our sister agencies and with the IRS. We have also other audit tools that I could talk about, but I think my time is probably out, Mr. Chair, but I haven't heard the bell.
Well, I think I'll stop you right there, Commissioner.
Thank you.
And we'll take a poll of the committee if they feel that they want to be able to ask you more and bring you back. We definitely will see if we can arrange a time here in short order to do that. Would that be okay with you?
Mr. Chair, I'd be happy to come, and if they want to send questions by mail, email is fine. And
all right.
We'll try to respond.
All right.
Thank you.
Mr.
Chair, Senator
just
Carlson.
One final thought, just perhaps to Mr. Salamone, your thought about the tax law and its complexity and compliance issue. Perhaps we would be able to take care of that quickly if we just eliminated all taxes. Just a thought.
Thank you, Senator Carlson. Commissioner, thank you very much.
Thank you.
And we'll be in touch. Thank you. The final item on the agenda is an overview of the Office of Attorney General. And we have Attorney General Lori Swanson here to present to the committee. Ms. Attorney General, thank you very much for taking time out of your busy schedule and appearing before the committee today.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. I appreciate your time and interest in the Office of the Attorney General, and appreciate very much what you do and the difficult issues you have before you as the state of Minnesota faces these very, very challenging financial times. You know, I'd like to talk a little bit about the Office of the Attorney General and some of the work that we do in the office. As I think everybody knows, we're the law firm for the state of Minnesota and also represent the people of the state of Minnesota on various issues ranging from consumer protection to antitrust enforcement to other issues as well. We represent every single agency, office holder, official in the government, all the boards, commissions of the government, the two officials who are just here before you today, we represent. We're the law firm for them as well. In any given year in our office, we have open about 7,500 case files. Those are court files that are open. So it's a very, very heavy volume of work, and it really runs the gamut across issues from minor cases, maybe a slip and fall if somebody leaves the Capitol and the Capitol didn't shovel very well on the steps and it's icy and you fall down and you get a whiplash and you sue the state of Minnesota, then we're the ones who defend the state of Minnesota, up to very, very large constitutional challenges of a magnitude that can go all the way to the Supreme Court. And so the issues are broad. The litigation is very, very sophisticated. It's complex civil litigation, not unusual in our cases, not only to be going up against the biggest law firms in the state of Minnesota, but in fact the biggest law firms in the country, and oftentimes multiple law firms on just one particular case. We defend and enforce the laws that you write. So when the legislature writes laws, oftentimes it's not uncommon that those laws are challenged. Well, in our office, then we defend those laws as you write them. I'll give you an example of that. You're all real familiar with the pension challenges facing the state of Minnesota, the unfunded nature of some of our pensions. And last year, the legislature reined in the cost of living increases on pension for current retirees so that the increase would not go up at the same rate as before. You did it to help equalize the disproportionate or the disparities in the pension funding. Well, not long after you did that, a lawsuit was filed by a variety of retirees against all of the state pension funds saying your action was unconstitutional, that you can't retroactively impair pension benefit rights. And so we're in court right now defending your pension reforms and have a hearing coming up here, I think, in March 22nd, before Judge Johnson in Ramsey County District Court, defending the constitutionality of those actions. Constitution challenges are very common in our office, oftentimes constitutional challenges to the sex offender laws, the civil commitment laws. You passed a law in the legislature to make it a crime for somebody to wrongfully accuse a police officer of misconduct. And that lawsuit or that law was quickly challenged by a woman who was accused of violating that statute, and we're before the Minnesota Supreme Court right now defending the constitutionality of that law. Common challenges to things like the DWI laws, breath testing instruments. There are about 260 machines, breathalyzer machines out there to detect people who are drinking while driving. There were challenges all the way to the Supreme Court in terms of the veracity of those instruments, and we've been defending that successfully, but defending it nevertheless. It can run the gamut. On allotment, obviously, was an issue last year. The governor's on allotment challenges or decisions were challenged. We defended the governor in that on allotment challenge all the way to the Minnesota Supreme Court. I suspect some of the issues that you all are grappling with now in terms of some of the budget issues and budget cuts will result in challenges. They always do. And when that happens, and if that time comes, then we would be the office that would defend those challenges. We do a lot to protect taxpayer resources. As I mentioned, in any given year in our office, we have about 7,500 lawsuits that are pending. And very frankly, people sue the state because they want money from the state. The state of Minnesota is often viewed as a deep pocket. It's often sued. And by defending those cases and defending them successfully, we do a lot to protect and preserve taxpayer dollars. Those cases can be both small and big. I mentioned the slip and fall, but they can also be very big and very hotly contested. The 35W bridge, when it fell down in the legislature, you didn't want the people who were injured or who died in the bridge collapse to have to sue the state to collect money. And so you appropriated, I think it was $37 million to a victim compensation fund so that the people who were hurt due to no fault of their own would not have to sue the state. But then ultimately there was very heavy duty litigation involving the various contractors on the bridge, the designer of the bridge, the company that put the gravel on top of the bridge, the consultant on the bridge. And we ended up so far recovering $7 million from some of those contractors relating to the bridge litigation, bringing it back in to help offset the cost of that compensation fund. And then I'll have one more case pending before the Supreme Court involving a company that was the designer of the bridge 40 years ago. And they're very sophisticated, complicated challenges involving something called the statute of repose because the bridge was built so long ago, and how do you sue the designer? And we're trying to fight to recover money for the state checkbook on that. We save resources by defending other tough decisions you have to make. The governor unallotted a program called the Sustainable Forest Incentive Act last year. The legislature ultimately ratified his unallotment. That was a program where companies are essentially paid when they don't develop land and allow Minnesotans to use the land for hunting and recreational use. And a lawsuit was just filed, actually, against the Minnesota Senate, the Minnesota House, the Department of Revenue, who was just here, and everybody under the sun, saying no, the legislative decision to unfund that essentially was a retroactive impairment of contract. And so we're representing you, defending the Senate in that, again, trying to uphold your law. The other litigation that is common, Department of Revenue was here, so there's a lot of tax litigation. If somebody's a tax cheat, they don't pay their taxes, Department of Revenue brings a claim, then we're the ones who represent that department. We have a Medicaid Fraud Control Unit. Obviously, as you look at your budget decisions, a big part of the budget pie is health and human services spending, welfare spending. There is fraud on the government when it comes to home health care agents and people who are trying to usurp money that you all appropriate and intend to go to the good purposes. And so we have a Medicaid Fraud Unit. Give you an example of a case. There's a Three Links Care Center in Northfield, and there was a woman who was getting care from that facility. She had about $1.5 million to her name, had plenty of money to pay for her own care. Her daughter ended up stealing her money. The result of that was that she ended up having to go in the public trough, nursing home wasn't getting paid, and the taxpayers of the state of Minnesota ended up paying for a woman who had plenty of assets to begin with. So through our office, we were able to bring a prosecution and get a conviction against her, again, with the eye toward punishing that type of misconduct, but then also trying to recover and bring back to the state money so it's used as intended and as appropriated by all of you. As I mentioned, we get thousands of these claims each year. They seek hundreds of millions of dollars from the state of Minnesota, and we defend them. We fight against them. You guys are all familiar with there are some municipalities, some places around the country where if a claim comes in, great, how much do you want? Government pays it, and they just dole out the money quickly. And a lot of those claims are frivolous. They're not meritorious. They may have to be litigated, but it doesn't make sense for the government to be paying out money, and so we fight and litigate those cases and try to preserve taxpayer dollars there. We provide a lot of assistance to county attorneys in the rural part of the state, especially on a variety of cases ranging from homicides to sex offender civil commitments. Give you an example, Senator Perry from your area, the Waseca farmhouse shooting of the Michael Zabawa, who shot Tracy Krueger, killed the 13-year-old son. I think the Waseca County Attorney's Office is a three-person shop, and so when that brutal farmhouse killing happened, they called up and said, would you send a veteran prosecutor in? We were able to send Bill Klump, who has probably tried more homicide cases than virtually anyone in the state, and he was able to get a successful conviction, which we then defended all the way up to the Minnesota Supreme Court. And that's true around the state of Minnesota. A lot of the rural killings and homicides that you see in the newspaper, like the Rock County killing of the state employee down in the southwestern corner of the state. She was a state worker, 21 years old. She was killed while on duty. Ultimately, it took 4 years, I think, to find her killer, but they had one homicide in about 35 years in Rock County, and when that happened in a little person shop, they called and said, would you send a veteran prosecutor in? And we did, and successfully got a conviction there. Two up in Morrison County, there was a homicide involving an individual named Jeremy Hull. He killed a fellow named Lewis Wilsek of Little Falls. He stole his identity. He took his money. He took his bank account. He took his truck, dismembered the body, buried it, burned it. And they came in and said, would you help prosecute that because we need the experience? And so we sent a prosecutor to do that. On the sex offender civil commitment cases, that's obviously back in the news in terms of sex offender civil commitments. Starting several years ago, the state of Minnesota began committing a lot of sex offenders who had served their time yet were committable under the law to St. Peter. And so we do for pretty much every rural county attorney, we help them on their sex offender commitment cases. Right now, we're handling a case in Crow Wing County of an individual. We just filed a petition a couple months ago involving an elementary school teacher. Some of you may be familiar with this one. He has four convictions for sexually assaulting young girls. He admitted to over 200 victims altogether. And so we're handling that commitment of that individual to St. Peter. In Goodhue County, there was an individual, Steve Hoagie. From the time he was a juvenile until the time he was age 43, he assaulted all kinds of young girls, ages 5 to 10, penetrated them, oral sex, and he's now committed to St. Peter because of the efforts of our office. And there are many, many of those cases. In addition, we do the implied consent revocation hearings on drunk driving. They're be charged criminally by the county attorney, but then when the commissioner of public safety is going to basically take the license, and we handle these implied consent revocation cases all around the entire state of Minnesota to keep these drunk drivers from driving when they've already offended against the state of Minnesota. You know, I want to just talk briefly about our budget as well and jump into that because I know your time is short as well. But I understand the magnitude of the problems that you face. You've got very, very large $6 billion deficit, and I don't envy you your job. You've got a lot of really hard decisions to make and to grapple with. In the case of our office, I think we've been an incredibly prudent steward of the state resources and an incredibly efficient user of the state dollar. A lot of agencies, when they come in for appropriations, you appropriate money, but ultimately it's a drain on the taxpayer resources. In our case, if I could just refer you to the first chart I handed out here, chart number one, we total budget, if you count everything, general fund, the federal funding we get, the agency partner funding is about $35 million. Last year, I think we recovered cash in hand to you in the checkbook, $60 million brought back in through some of these efforts that I mentioned, like the bridge litigation, and saved well over $100 million by defending these challenges. So you can kind of see the left hand is our budget, the right hand of the column, chart one, is the savings and the money that we're bringing back into the state through your appropriation. If you look at chart two from a budget perspective, we have dramatically reduced the size of our office. I know you're familiar with the overall growth in state employees and growth in state funding, but that's not the case in our office. Just chart two shows over the last 10 years, you can see the appropriation to our office going down markedly over the last 10 years. At the same time, the work of the office has gone up dramatically. In bad economic times, you need lawyers. There are more criminal activity. There are more claims against the state of Minnesota. You know, if somebody is fired by the Department of Human Services in a good economy, they might get a new job. In a bad economy, they sue the Department of Human Services, and then we're the guys who defend that type of litigation. If you go to chart three, I just want to show you the size of our office. If you look at the left-hand column, the kind of the teal color, at one point in 1998, the office had 537 employees. Today, there's about 315 employees. We have cut the number of assistant attorney generals, cut the number of legal assistants, and cut the number of clerical staff pretty markedly over the years. And so you compare that to the rest of government that's probably gone up in terms of employees. We've gone down, and we're doing a lot of work with what we have. And you're raising your hand. Yes, Mr.
Senator
Chairman.
Senator Cohen has a question.
Sure, Senator.
Mr. Chairman and General Swanson, I'm all for efficiency, yeah. and I've participated in,
yes.
in a lot
yeah.
of work with your office. But
you did.
What are we doing? What are we not doing now with 242
yeah.
Assistant Attorney Generals, now 132? What's not getting done?
Well, there are challenges. I mean, we can't take every referral. For example, when the rural county attorneys call and say, can you help with a particular case, we have to be selective. We have to make decisions about when we can help and when we can't. We try to prioritize it, helping the smaller offices, targeting the more brutal crimes. But absolutely, Senator Cohen, there are cases where we are not able to bring them, other cases where there's been fraud, and we don't have the resources to bring it. It's prosecutorial discretion. You try to pick and choose, and when you have finite resources, as much as you can, try to pick and choose which cases you get involved in and which ones you don't. But there is absolutely no doubt we cannot be involved in every case where I think we could add value and do good work if we had the opportunity to do it, but we simply don't have the resources. Yeah.
Senator Cohen.
Just follow up, I know the next chart
yeah.
shows
yeah.
The comparison between the AG's office, mm-hmm. Ramsey, and Hennepin.
Mm-hmm.
And I was involved, but I forget,
yep.
was it 10 years ago? I'm not sure. In terms of trying to establish some equity
mm-hmm.
relative to the state attorney generals, with responsibilities arguably
yeah.
Significantly more complex
yes.
than local county attorneys.
Yes.
Is that getting out of whack, or we're...
It is, absolutely, Mr. Chairman and Senator Cohen, it is absolutely out of whack because I think in the case of our office, we are handling primarily very extraordinarily complicated civil litigation. And as I mentioned, the people that are our opponents in the courtroom tend to be the biggest law firms. They tend to pay, I mean, starting lawyer at a big law firm makes more than I make as attorney general. And throughout the state, that's a very much a challenge. County attorney's offices, by and large, are handling criminal cases, but in the cases that we're handling, they're extraordinarily complicated civil cases where opposite side of the courtroom table are lawyers who are paid a lot more, and the lawyers in the county attorney's offices are paid more on average than the lawyers in the attorney general's office, that's because of these cuts that we've had, and so it's a challenge for the state going forward in terms of being able to compensate and retain people. You want to fight fire with fire. You get what you pay for. And being able to attract and have the caliber of the people who can take these sophisticated cases is a challenge.
And Mr. Chairman, just
Senator Cohen.
A very quick comment.
Yeah.
I think when you made this yeah. argument, or your predecessors yeah. made this argument in the past, you weren't even looking to, say, get a salary range comparable to, say, Dorsey
no.
or Fabry.
No.
You were looking to get a range comparable to, say, Hennepin or Ramsey.
Yes. Mr. Chairman, Senator Cohen, that's exactly the case. And right now we are not comparable salary-wise, not anywhere close to Hennepin and Ramsey. Attorney who is handling an assault case in that county may be paid significantly more than an attorney in our office who's handling something that goes to the Minnesota Supreme Court where you're dealing with, you know, potentially hundreds of millions of dollars. And that is a problem and a very, very real challenge. Great. Mr. Chairman, that's kind of the budget, I touched a little bit on what it means. But at the end of the day, we've had these very draconian cuts. We've absorbed it thus far by working as hard as we possibly can. We're not in a position any more cuts. I mean, there will be cases that come in and claims that are filed where we're simply going to have to tell state agencies, you know, pay the money. We don't have a lawyer to represent you. And at the end of the day, I don't think that's an efficient use of the taxpayer dollar or a good use of the taxpayer dollar. We're kind of situated like the courts in the sense that cases come in and you do want to put a lawyer on them and do a workmanlike job on them and defend them. And that's really how I would equate our office. So I appreciate your time. Happy to take any questions if there are any. Or
Senator Thompson.
Mr. Chairman, Attorney General Swanson, thank you. Obviously, there's been a lot of talk nationwide and statewide about the federal health care plan. And I believe it's 28, don't quote me exactly, I think it's 28 states that have taken that on. Your office has chosen not to do that. Mm-hmm. So one general question, maybe just a couple brief follow-ups if the chair
sure.
allows. Do you view the Attorney General's role in part to be to defend our sovereignty as a state, to defend our interest against what would be encroachment of the federal government that you believe to violate the 10th Amendment? Do you view that as a part of the role of the Attorney General?
Yes, Mr. Chairman, Senator Thompson, speaking to the health care litigation, I think you're right. The number is somewhere 25, 26, 28. I'm not sure. It's changing every day. And there were some states that filed a lawsuit against the federal government. And ultimately, there are four courts that have looked at the litigation on the merits, two courts that have issued a ruling on the merits said that the law was constitutional. Two courts that looked at it on the merits said it's not constitutional. Right now, all these cases are kind of going up to the various circuit court of appeals for the federal system, heading toward the U.S. Supreme Court that will ultimately one day make a decision on the merits as to whether or not the law is constitutional. In that particular case, I decided not to weigh in that litigation. Ultimately, the case is heading to the Supreme Court with or without Minnesota. And one of the things I have to do as an office is look at and balance these various issues and resources and can't get involved in every possible decision. There are times that I have filed lawsuits against the federal government, however, and part of the job of the Attorney General is to represent the people of Minnesota. And absolutely there are times I filed lawsuits against the federal government. I filed a lawsuit against the Obama administration on Asian carp. I happen to believe that the federal government's not doing enough to keep Asian carp out of the Great Lakes, and Army Corps of Engineers is threatening to let them in through Chicago, and if they get into Lake Michigan, they can come into Lake Superior. We are a fishing state, and a big part of our economy deals with fishing. And so that was a case where I weighed in, and I did file a lawsuit.
Senator Thompson.
Yeah, and I understand the other sure. states are doing it, and the issues, look it up, they're, of course, you know, you represent me and this body. Yep. They don't. In your professional opinion, which matters because you make these decisions.
Sure.
Do you believe that the individual mandate, as it's become to be known, is a legitimate exercise of federal power under the Commerce Clause?
Attorney General Swanson.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Thompson, ultimately the issue is going to be weighed by the Supreme Court, and it's the Supreme Court that's going to decide whether or not the law is constitutional or isn't constitutional. In this case, I looked at some precedent. There is a case involving medicinal marijuana out of California where the Supreme Court issued an opinion, and they essentially concluded that the federal Congress does have broad authority to regulate interstate commerce. Healthcare is 1/6 of our economy. Personally, I'm not such a fan of the individual mandate, just as a personal matter. But when I look at these things, I look at them as legal matters. And in that case, I decided it's not warranted. Ultimately, there's going to be a higher court than one state attorney general who decides it, and they're going to set the legal precedent for the country.
Yeah. Mr. Well, Chair, if I may be indulged for one more.
Senator Thompson.
I understand the court will decide it.
Sure.
But I think it can't be emphasized enough that your opinion matters.
Sure.
Because you represent us in these situations. If, in fact, this mandate turns out to be deemed to be constitutional, can you think of an example of any kind of federal regulation as it pertains to the economy that then couldn't be justified under what we called the Commerce Clause, although actually the wording of the Constitution is commerce among the several states? Can you think of anything that wouldn't justifiably be regulated by the federal government then?
Attorney General.
Yeah, Mr. Chairman, Senator Thompson, I mean, ultimately, the Supreme Court will issue the ruling and they'll define the boundaries of this and whether this individual mandate is or is not constitutional, and then you'd apply the precedent to that particular ruling. I mean, each case you take differently. You take it on the merits. I have a letter I can share with you that I sent to Governor Pawlenty kind of laying out my rationale behind this, and would be happy to share that to you. But, yeah, I absolutely can foresee that there could be plenty of things that aren't constitutional depending on how the ruling comes down. Absolutely.
Okay, thank
absolutely.
You.
Yeah, thank you for your questions.
Mr. Chairman, I would like to ask a quick question, if you don't mind. I
know Senator Torres Ray.
We've run out of time.
Sure.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Ms. Swanson, first of all, I want to say thank you for your service, and I know that this issue of salaries is a big issue in your office. I happen to know several people who have come to work mm-hmm. in your office, mm-hmm. and they are quickly recruited after they are trained in your
sure.
office
mm-hmm.
by companies that pay a lot more.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that is very concerning to mm-hmm. me, and it should be very concerning to all of us in this committee and the state, because you have the reputation to have an office that really trains people well, but then when they are ready to work for you, then they leave.
Mm-hmm.
So could you give us briefly an idea of how that is taking place in your office and how problematic that is for you that we don't have competitive salaries for those attorneys that work for you?
Sure, absolutely. Mr. Chairman, Senator Torres Ray, it is a constant challenge in the office because, as I mentioned, our competitors are not, lawyers don't leave our office to go work for a county attorney's office. When they leave the office, they would go work for a private firm, and it's not uncommon for lawyers to be making, hundreds of thousands of dollars, literally more than they make in our office. And it's also not uncommon for, as we try to recruit lawyers, that people will take pay cuts, six-figure pay cuts to come. They do it because they believe in serving the public. They want to do the mission, but at the end of the day, you still have to pay the mortgage and pay the car and send the kids to college. And so it is a very serious challenge. And because of the sophisticated nature of the litigation that we're handling, you do need to fight fire with fire, and you need people who are able to take on the opponents on the other side of the courtroom. And so it's an ongoing pressure, and you're not going to do it by, having people who don't have the sophistication and the wherewithal to take those kind of cases.
Thank you.
One thing I could say,
sir,
is I could sit and listen to you and Senator Thompson and Senator Cohen go back and forth all day. It is truly interesting in how you do that. And I really thank you for your time and the overview of your department.
Well, Mr. Chairman and members, thank you. They say only a lawyer can write a 50-page document, and then we call them briefs, right, guys? I mean, so I appreciate you having me come before you, and I appreciate what you do and the complicated nature of your work and what you're doing to serve the public as well. Thank you very much.
Thank you very
thank
much.
Thank you so much.
Members, we're going to schedule The schedule will come out tomorrow for next week, but we're going to try to finish the overviews up next week, so we're going to be pretty aggressive with it, because I know after that